I think the topic, intuition and rigor, is very interesting because these are two things that are often seen as in opposition to each other. And I don't think that's at all the case. I think that we have to look at them as being very closely related and intertwined, and each one feeding to the other. Now, I think what happens is that when we're born into the world, there's a lot of structure around us that we somehow have to come to grips with us. And as we grow older, we make some kind of worldview to somehow fit things into place, somehow make things coincide. And I think this is particularly true in mathematics, that we live in a world where there's a world of plurality, a world of shapes and forms and so on, and we have a worldview. Now, this worldview is what gives rise to our intuition. And the intuition is faulty. It's kind of an inductive procedure that we have a way of looking at something which may prove not to be quite so sufficient, so we keep revising and altering this. The problem in mathematics is that these structures are often very deep. And so, if students are to proceed in mathematics, they need teaching which helps the person solidify these structures, think of them in a way that's important. Now, teaching in some sense is a very dangerous activity because it's partly creative and partly destructive. That we're dealing with students who are not blank pages. They've been exposed to number, they've been exposed to shape and form, and they have some ideas, however ill-formed, and certainly in most cases, not very well articulated about what these things involve. And sometimes in teaching, it's a matter of helping the people change this worldview into something that's more productive. So sometimes you're in the business of destroying or altering something that's already there. The creative side is how to do this in a way that respects the learner but draws the learner along. So how do we solidify this structure? Well, we solidify it through making definitions, by making explicit the concepts that we introduce and by drawing attention to relationships among them. And the structures that we have are structures of plurality, combinatorics, how to count things, how things fit together, geometry, form, symmetry. Symmetry is something that we all respond to, that we all react to. It's something that we don't pay very much explicit attention to in school. Ratio is something else that comes up in everyday life, the idea of scale, changing the size of something. We're inevitably talking about rates. So inevitably, the learner gets some ideas about rate. We talk about magnitude, area, volume, length, and mass. And all of these feed into our intuition, which is a kind of irrational take on what the situation actually is. And our experience then governs what sense we have of them. Now, what we need to do is to somehow, if we're going to do mathematics, somehow begin to make these things more precise, make things consistent, so we're free of paradox, of contradictions, and try and develop the right sort of way of representing these in our mind, the right metaphors to think about these things. Basically, what we're doing is that we have some kind of latent structure, some latent mathematical structure, and we have to formulate this. We do this through a notation which somehow reflects what these structures are. And we not only have to reflect them, but we have to sharpen them. We have to enable people to manipulate the symbolism, these representations, so that they can go ever more deeper. And this is where the idea of rigor comes in. Now, we have to be very careful with rigor because the rigorization has to be always done in such a way that is meaningful. So that we have this movement in a circle from what sort of pictorial or concrete the ideas that we have into some kind of formalism, some kind of abstraction. And every time we go around the loop, we do it a little more deeply. So first of all, we have the idea of plurality, the idea of sense of number in particular instances, which leads to the abstract idea of number, which leads to a notation of arithmetic, the representation of numerals, the representation of operations on the numerals, the laws of these, which then allow us to think of numbers themselves as an entity in their own right, and therefore we begin to develop an intuition about these, and then we step into the situation of word problems, which lead into algebraic equations. We develop a notation to deal with these. And then, as we go around the loop, the variables themselves begin to have their own reality, and so we can think of their variables, and we develop our intuition about the variables. And then at the next stage of the loop, we have the idea of a function. So instead of particular instances of functions, we begin to comprehend the general idea of functions. And once again, we have an intuition about what functions are. So we have this kind of loop of increasing formalism and rigor, which leads to a deeper level of intuition, which leads back to a deeper level of intuition, and so on. So I think that when we think about intuition and rigor, we have to think of this very dynamic feedback loop where one feeds into the other, one informs the other. That the rigor, we make sense of the rigor through our intuition about what's going on, but our intuition becomes more sound because we're able to import into the situation the rigor. Now, the rigor operates at two levels. There's the level of the teacher herself, that before the students are introduced to the formalism of mathematics, I think it's very important for the teacher to have a clear idea of what the concepts are, so that when the teacher gives the students a task or an experience, it's done in such a way that the message is a kind of consistent message and the student gets a powerful picture or representation of what is going on. So let me then review what I think are the responsibilities of the teacher in this situation. To provide experiences and to set tasks that will provide the maximum amount of clarity and the minimum amount of ambiguity. To foster exploration and communication among pupils so that they will become engaged. That is, if we're going to develop rigor and precise thinking amongst the students, it has to be in the basis of something that's actually made real to them. And so one of the productive directions of modern education in school is that it does foster investigation, problem-solving, communication, and so on. And these are all tools where the student becomes engaged. What the student is doing becomes important to the student. And so you develop questions and open the way to conundrums and create in the students a kind of imperative to resolve these questions, to resolve these conundrums. So that questions become important to the student and the adequate and solid resolution of these questions becomes a matter of moment. The third thing, the fourth thing is to provide students with the tools of cogent mathematical analysis, which is partly reasoning and logic, the ability to analyze, and also the notation, the formalism of mathematics, which they can play with. To encourage awareness of details, that's partly looking out for patterns, expecting that mathematics will have a kind of richness. Unfortunately, a lot of the traditional mathematics, which is rule-bound, works against students seeing mathematics as a rich enterprise. Mathematics is often presented as a kind of finite box where you learn the rules, you apply the rules, and you memorize a few things, and that's all there is to it. Part of the game, I think, is for students to go into mathematics with this kind of expectation that they can explore around, they can mess around, and no matter how much they find, no matter how much they see, there's more there that can be discovered. There's more there that can be found. And I think if they have this expectation that they're never going to get the complete story, but what they can get is this ever-increasing richness, this ever-increasing depth, this ever-increasing sense of encompassing what's going on, but something that's dynamic and always growing, then I think we're setting them up for this kind of loop of intuition and rigor to take place. So that what we want to see happening at all levels of education is a slow process of maturation and awareness of need to ground one's thoughts in something kind of solid. I think the thing that we need to feel about rigor is that the student has to know at some stage they can provide a solid base in which to think about mathematics, a solid base from which to go further, a solid base for their intuition. And yet, always see the dynamic, always see that they should still continue to think about things, that they can't slot things into a kind of formalism, that the formalism has its own life, its own ability to be thought about, and to be thought about metaphorically and by analogy. Another way I put it is that one purpose of school is to elevate taste. That is, whatever it is that you're teaching, whether it's literature or history or mathematics or science, it's a sense of moving beyond the situation where the student is, the everyday life of lotteries and business and pop songs and everything else, and saying to them that there's a whole rich world out there to be explored, and what we want to do is to get you into that world. Well, I thought I wouldn't talk about generalities for very long, and so what I'd like to do is to look at a few problems, as many as I have time for, and also to make a bit of a case study, the teaching of fractions in school, I think to illustrate some of the thoughts that I have. Just to paraphrase a word from scriptures, I think whenever you're dealing with students at any level, you always have to keep in mind that sufficient unto the day is the rigor thereof. In other words, you be as rigorous as it is to make sense to the student, that you never find yourself in the business of answering questions that the students are not asking, and if you want to answer the questions, then you have to set up the students to be prepared to ask the questions in the first place. As a teacher, you have to be opportunistic. And I find that when I'm teaching students or I'm talking to kids at different levels, situations arise. And sometimes you're in a position where a kid will say something and then you ask a question. And that just opens things up. And you pounce upon the uncertainties. Sometimes a kid will get up and say something and some other kid will disagree with it. Well, if that happens, then you've got it ready-made, because that creates the imperative for some kind of clarity. Pounce upon facile thinking. If a student says something, maybe you've got a small counterexample, or maybe somebody else has got a small counterexample. That really sets the cat amongst the pigeons. So let's look at a couple of simple questions. Let me ask you to think about this for a minute. Can a product of two whole numbers, positive integers, ever be a perfect square? Okay. Now, what is your feeling about this? Is it simply, I don't know? I mean, I have absolutely no idea. Or do you have an opinion on the matter? Yes. Yes. Oh, consecutive. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, I'm error-prone, so one of the things that my students learn early when I'm lecturing them is if they have some question, please put up their hand and ask me, because it probably means that I've done something stupid. And so, can a product of two consecutive whole numbers ever be a perfect square? How many think that they have an answer to that question? Okay. Now, is the answer yes or no? But they have to be positive integers. Zero is non-negative. So first of all, we have to clarify the definition. Okay. So you think the answer is no. Do you have any basis for that opinion? Yes. Okay. How many would agree that it's not possible for the product of two consecutive positive integers to be a perfect square? Okay. Now, let's look at this. Is this something that you feel just has to be right? Or are you prepared to give a little bit of chapter and verse to this? How ought we to think about this? If you have an intuition about it, where does that intuition come from? Is there something latent? Is there a kind of proof that's lurking between that intuition? Yes.
That you would get a rectangle, not a square.
You get a rectangle. Yes. Okay. Can we sort of pull that out a little bit more? Okay. Okay. You see what's happening here? We've got a kind of image that's going on. Okay. That the product of two consecutive whole numbers conjured up the idea of a rectangle. Okay, whose dimensions are unequal. Now, what's that got to do with whether or not it's a square? Because, I mean, if I had, say, 9 times 16, we can think of a rectangle of dimensions 9 times 16, but, of course, 9 times 16 is also a square. When you're on the bus on the way home, you might think of how to split a 9 times 16 rectangle by two straight cuts into three pieces that can be rearranged to form a square. I'll leave that as a homework assignment. Okay. Yes?
The length being one more than the width, if you take the square,
yes.
You've got the strip.
Yes.
It's intuition.
yeah, it is intuition. Okay, because the idea is, let me turn this other thing on here. You've got this rectangle. Oh, I see they've already provided, so I won't use them. Okay, so if I cut one off, then I've got a square there. And then if I sort of do that, I've got a square there. Okay. So there's an intuitive way of looking at it, that this rectangle, whose dimensions differ by one, can be sort of fitted in between a smaller green square and a larger green square. Okay, let's start to tighten that up a bit. Can we now begin to make this precise? How does that show that the area of this rectangle can't be a square number? What's the crucial thing that we've got to bring to the front of our mind? Pardon? Yes, what sort of... Between two consecutive squares, okay. So the idea that we've got to bring forward to make this a bit more rigorous is the idea of two consecutive squares. So if, for example, we want to see that 272 times 273 is not a square, we simply notice that that's less than 273 squared and bigger than 272 squared. And these are consecutive squares, which means that there's no square in between them. Okay, so any number that lies between these things is consecutive. Okay, so here we've taken an intuitive idea, and we've begun to rigorize it. Now, let's look at the benefit of this. First of all, is there anything in this that a grade 5 kid would not understand? If we were to go into this level of detail with a grade 5 kid. Would a grade 5 kid, say an 11-year-old, I guess, be incapable of understanding the issue? But what we do by bringing out this is sort of building on the intuition, but we're raising some very important points. This idea that as we take successive squares, they're increasing, and so there's nothing in between 272 squared and 273 squared that's squared. The other thing is that if we have a product and we increase one of the multipliers, then we increase the product as a whole. So increasing a multiplier in a product increases the product as a whole. So there's something in terms of inequalities that we're facing at. Now what we're doing now is sort of getting a kind of lower level, higher level of intuition going on, the sense that if A is less than B and C is positive, then A times C is less than B times C. So that rigorizing this arithmetic fact about the product of two numbers is also providing a basis of experience, when we make it explicit, for students to understand more generally in inequalities, and this may bear fruit maybe in 4 years or 5 years if we're doing this with grade five kids, that if we have an inequality and we multiply the two sides of the inequality by something positive, we preserve the inequality. So that becomes part of their intuitive baggage when they think about it. So this is a little bit of what I mean by this kind of feedback loop, that you rigorize things sufficiently, you take the intuition, you bring it out, and then you're also providing the basis for a deeper level of intuition. There are other things that we can look at. If we want to look at sort of pattern recognition, we can actually look at the first few examples. And there are other things that you might notice. One thing that you might notice is that if I multiply these numbers by 4, 4 times 2 is 8, 4 times 6 is 24, 4 times 12 is 48, I still get one. I get one less than a perfect square. Okay? It's not impossible, and I speak from experience on it, it's not impossible when you get kids chewing away at things to notice things like that. Okay? Okay, so if I know that 4 times 2 is one less than a perfect square, and 4 times 6, and 4 times 12, and 4 times 20, and 4 times 30 are all one less than a perfect square, so what? Well, this would be a square if and only if 4 times it was a square. Okay, so now what you're doing is you're shining light on something else. That if I have a square, and I multiply it by a square, then I get a further square. Okay? So that if any of these were square, then 4 times it would be a square, but it looks like 4 times it plus 1 is a square. Okay, so that would mean that we have two positive squares that differ by 1. Now this question actually came up once when I was talking to a group of grade 9 and 10 students. We were doing some question, and a student said, oh, well, this can't happen because two positive squares can't differ by 1. And I was prepared to let the matter ride when some kid put his hand up. Why can't two positive squares differ by 1? Terrific. So I said to the class, okay, explain to this kid why two positive squares can't differ by 1. And they proceeded to tie themselves in knots. Okay? The students, so this created the imperative. Some kid didn't understand what was going on. The rest of them had the job of making it clear to them. And they were starting to get into all sorts of trouble. Now, how did this thing get resolved in the end? Whoops. Let's see, how long is this cord? Oh, okay, this is good. Got lots of repair. Well, they were getting into all sorts of involved arguments. So finally I said, well, let's suppose that we've got two numbers, A. I could do this in grade 9 because they've had a little bit of algebra. And we have that a squared minus b squared is equal to 1. Well, then they'd already studied difference of squares, so I could present them with this. And then the question is, well, when are two positive integers have a product of 1? Well, that can happen if and only if two of the factors is equal to 1, both the factors is equal to 1, and that can happen if and only if a is 1 and b is equal to 0, and we're supposing that the numbers are positive, so we can't have it. Now, I like this very much, you see, because the students learn how to factor difference of squares. And they do all these crazy exercises at the back of the chapter, and they do it. But they never or very rarely see why it's important to know how to factor difference of squares. The point of an algebraic manipulation is that you want to deal with information. You have an algebraic expression, and there's information in that expression. Some of it is manifest and some of it is latent. And the point of changing the form of the expression is to bring the latent information forward so that you can shine a light on it. And the important point here is that having the factorization of difference of squares means that you can write it as a product of two things. And then you can sort of feed that back in. So the rigor here, first of all, it turned out to be simpler than any of the explanations that the students were trying to put forward. Okay, so it's simple and concise. The second thing is that it informed a technique that the students were learning in their grade 9 class, for which they probably otherwise had no need for. And the third thing is it illustrated mathematical power. It meant that algebra is there because you can deal with things in a very effective and concrete manner. Okay? And this is a message that very often we don't get across to the students, that the point of mathematics is that it's powerful. It's a powerful way of dealing with ideas. And part of that power resides in our intuition, in our representation, in our pictures, and part of that power resides in the formalism and the rigor and the logical reasoning. Okay? Another way of looking at it is that we have two consecutive numbers. The greatest common divisor of these two numbers has to be 1, so if the product is a square, each of them has to be a square, and we've already seen that two squares can't differ by 1. Okay, so there are a whole lot of ways that you can get into this. Now, that sort of explanation probably you couldn't try in anything earlier than grade 8 because the kids have to understand a little bit about greatest common divisor, and so there's some deeper ideas that are involved there. But being willing to engage these gives the students a much better sense of place. Now, I'd like to move to a slightly different problem. What I call the falling ladder property problem. Okay. So, let's suppose that we have a ladder. There's a ladder. Leaning against the wall. And the ladder is such that it's vertical, stretching up the wall, and then all of a sudden it falls over so that the base stays where the wall meets the ground. Okay? So the green lines represent the positions of the ladder as it falls over. What is the path traced out by the midpoints of the ladder as it falls down? Well, that's pretty easy. It's a quarter circle. Okay? The top of the ladder traces out a circle, and the midpoint also traces out a quarter circle. Okay. Now, what's really behind that? Well, I guess really what's behind that is a kind of sense of the dilation. I mean, that's what governs our intuition, the fact that we're sort of coming halfway in. And so if we have a quarter circle traced out by the top of the ladder, then if we come halfway in, the halfway point halfway up the ladder is also traced by a quarter circle. Okay. So let's put the ladder against the wall. And this time, let's suppose that the ladder falls down to the ground again, but it does so in a different way. Okay, the bottom part of the ladder slides out. Okay, so the top slides down the wall while the bottom slides along the ground. So we're going like this. So the green lines represent successive positions of the ladder in this case. Okay, now let me ask the question again. What is the path traced out by the midpoint of the ladder? Any thoughts? Quarter circle. Why do you say that? Okay. What leads you to that?
Visualization.
Okay. Can you? Okay. Visualization. Any other thoughts on this? Yes.
A line. And that's just an intuition. I've got no understanding as to why I'm
okay,
saying
so you're thinking, is this just a sort of line going down? Okay. Any other thoughts on this? Yes?
The symmetry of it would seem to indicate that you would expect, if you did that all the way around, you'd get at least some sort of elliptical shape or oval shape or something like that.
Okay.
And since it's symmetric in both dimensions, I wouldn't expect it to be extended one way rather than the other.
Okay.
Suggest a circle.
suggest the circle. Okay, so somehow symmetry is lurking in the background. Any other thoughts?
Hyperbola.
Hyperbola. Okay, so we've got the following, that some people think it's a... Is that what you mean by the circle? Okay. And then some people think it's like that. And then some people think, well, maybe it's a kind of hyperbola that goes down like that. Okay. Is there anything that we can say about the symmetry of it, since that seems to be part of the picture? Yes?
If you started in the middle like that and attached the center of the ladder to the origin and then had another piece.
Yeah.
And then you rotated it, then you just trace the locus of that piece.
Okay, so in other words, you're sort of drawing a line like that?
Yeah.
And then you're sort of moving.
And start again, yeah.
Okay, and then so you want to find out what happens to that piece?
Yeah.
Okay, so what does happen to it?
Well, doesn't it stay attached to the ladder as it rotates around? I mean, as it falls?
Okay, I'm not sure I understand exactly what you're constrained at.
That piece stay attached to... I mean, if both ends of the ladder are attached to the wall, then that piece would stay attached to the ladder and to the origin.
Okay, but how are you defining this piece exactly? I mean...
Attached to the middle of the ladder.
Yeah, but on the face of it, the length of this piece could vary as the ladder goes down.
Well, maybe it doesn't, because it's the same. It's half the length of the ladder.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, it's the geometry.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Okay, so you've got a little bit of prior knowledge on that. You'd have to work it out. Okay. Anyhow.
You're saying we're not allowed to use the fact that the midpoint of the hypotenuse is half of the hypotenuse.
Well, I'm not saying anything about that. I mean, you could if you wanted to. Okay. Yeah, okay. So some of you, of course, have a little bit of advanced knowledge that might help you along in this. And, of course, you see, if you know things about right-angle triangles, then you know that the center of the hypotenuse is the circumcircle of the right-angle triangle. And so these three lines are equal. And so that really reinforces the idea that the thing is really coming down a circle. I mean, the thing that's wild about this is that whether the ladder is falling this way or whether it's falling this way, the locus is actually the same quarter circle. Okay. But let's look at it from a kind of intuitive point of view, how our intuition can be taught. First of all, there is some things that I think should be brought to mind, is that if I sort of turned it that way, so the ground becomes the wall and the wall becomes the ground, then I think you can see that the whatever the curve is, it's going to be symmetrical about this 45-degree line. Okay, so in other words, and all of these three things sort of fill the bill, the hyperbola idea or the straight line. Okay, so, but anyhow, that I find is not something that everybody recognizes. That in the eyes of some people's intuition, the ground has a slightly different status than the wall. So I think that the intuition needs to be taught for some people that there is this basic symmetry about the situation, and if I just tip things up and interchange the role of the wall and the ground. Now, the thing is, how can we establish this? Because, of course, this is something that's really open to some debate if you try this in a different group. Okay, so people will differ, and they may differ for very good reasons. Now, of course, we got a bit of a red herring, because I think what happens to some people's intuition is that they're sort of caught up by the envelope of the positions of the ladder. And, of course, the envelope is a kind of hyperbola-like curve. And so they think that somehow the envelope gives us an indication as to how the middle of the ladder is going to go. So the middle of the ladder is going to be some kind of transform of the envelope. Okay, so there's something there where the intuition could go wrong. You haven't quite got the right worldview of it. Now, the thing that bothers me about this proof, you can also do it with analytic geometry. If you do it with analytic geometry, then it's a triviality. Okay, so if you're in grade 10 or something like that, then you just set up the equation, see it's obviously a quarter circle, so that's no problem. But the thing that sort of bothers me about this proof is that it kind of goes backwards, okay? Because basically, you start with the ladder, you start with the midpoint, and the question is, okay, you sort of can argue by contradiction. That is, you have this situation, and then you go and get a contradiction argument to show that, okay, the midpoint moves in the circle. Whereas if you sort of start from scratch and say, okay, let's join this, then you kind of have the duty to somehow show that this line here is equal to that. And I don't see a really neat way to do that in the direct argument. But, and I thought, well, if I was to have to tell, say, kids in grade 6 why this was so, that's, I think, a fairly sophisticated way of looking at it for a grade 6 kid. Okay, because there's a kind of implicit contradiction argument there. And, of course, you have to go into this whole thing about the properties of a right triangle, which I think is a little bit beyond the pale for grade 6 students. So I started to wonder, well, how can I show this? Well, now, what's happening here? Okay. That's okay. We'll fix it up afterwards. We've got a modest vivendi here, so. I want you to think of an ironing board. Okay? Now, the ironing board I have at home sits on legs like this. Okay? And when you fold up the ironing board, this end is fixed. And what happens is that this leg sort of slides along so that as you fold up the ironing board, the legs sort of look like this. Okay? And then you sort of move this into there and then you tuck the legs up underneath the ironing board. Okay? Well, the ironing board is actually a kind of nice indication of what's going on because there's our walls. Here's the ladder on the way down. Now, let me have two ladders, each falling in its own way. So one ladder sort of falling like this, and the other ladder sort of falling like this. Okay. And so let me draw a position of the ladder that's falling fixed into the corner. And let this angle be equal to this. Okay. So in other words, I'm relating the positions of the ladder so that this position of the ladder with this angle corresponds to this position of the ladder with the same angle. Now, what have I really got here? Well, what I've really got here is a rectangle. Okay. Now, what do I know about a rectangle? What I know about a rectangle is that diagonals bisect each other. So all of these suckers are equal. Okay. So what that means is that this point, which is at the midpoint of both the ladders, is such that its distance from the origin always remains the same. That is half the length of the ladder. And therefore, well, we know that the locus of a point which maintains a fixed distance from a given point, the origin, has to be a quarter circle. And so what we have by this sort of ironing board intuition of the problem, so this is the fixed point in the ironing board, and these are the two legs of the ironing board, which I'm sort of folding down. So you can think of this end being the ironing board, and these are the legs. So what I do here in one swell swoop is that I get both the loci to be the same. That is, the midpoint of both the ladders is tracing along this quarter circle. Now, there may be an easier way to explain this to grade 6 kids. I'd be very happy if you have any thoughts that don't get us even into high school geometry, but that's about the simplest thing that I could come up with. But you see, even at coming up with that kind of proof, the ironing board sort of gave me a representation to think about the problem, okay? And it's sort of a matter of taking the situation and sort of giving it a kind of representation which helps the intuition and helps me really understand that basically I've got this ironing board situation with the legs crossing at the midpoint. Okay. Now, what I'd like to do is to close with... Now, in the packet, I had 6 problems that I might talk about. I've only talked about 2 of them. So you might look at the other problems in the packet and see how they go. What I'd like to do in the remaining time is to talk about a very big topic in high school, which is notorious for the difficulty that it seems to cause for students. And that's the question of fractions. Okay? Now, the good news about fractions is that you've got 6 years of elementary school to teach it. Okay? You can start talking about fractions when kids are in grade one, and you can give them all sorts of experience with fractions, and then by the time they get to grade six, then by that time you should be able to have taught them how to multiply and add fractions and deal with them, so they should be entirely comfortable. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite work out that way. And I think one of the reasons it doesn't work out that way is that we forget the biblical injunction that a house divided in itself cannot stand. And I think that what happens as kids go through school is that they never get a clear idea of what a fraction is. Okay? They get kind of vague ideas of fractions. Now, there's a whole lot of things tied up in fractions. There's the idea of ratio and proportion, the idea that the fraction is a number. You have sort of fractions of discrete amounts, fractions of aerial amounts, and so on. So kids get pizzas and balls surrounded by loops and number lines and everything else, and it's all mixed in together. So I think that part of the rigorization that has to go on for fractions, first of all, has to go on with the teacher and with the curriculum. And that rigorization begins with, what is the primary idea that we want kids to have about fractions? We can bring in the other ideas later on. And my belief is that the first thing that we need kids to realize about fractions is that they are numbers. Okay? Now, the tool for doing this, the intuitive foundation for this, I think, is the tape measure. And this is quite natural. Okay, let's go into a kitchen of a typical family that has a five-year-old. What will we find on the door? We will find a little mark on the door, because that's how tall Johnny is. And these marks are sort of going up a little higher as Johnny gets a little bit older, okay? And so we can come along and we can measure the height from the floor to these marks. Okay, we can do it with a tape measure. And we realize, or Johnny can realize, that as we do this, he's very seldom a whole number of inches. Okay, he's growing gradually, okay? So we can represent his height by the number on the tape measure, but integers just won't cut it. We need to somehow go between the integers. And this is where the fractions come in. So there's a very natural way of talking about a half an inch or a quarter of an inch or so on. This actually is one reason that I like imperial measure, because it's a little more natural a forum for fractions than metric is in this particular context. But I think we can still make the point, okay? So once you've sort of got the intuitive foundation laid by the tape measure, we can then go on to the number line, okay? So we can think of fractions as being placed along a number line. Okay. Now, of course, as Johnny gets taller, we can describe how he's changing in height. So maybe he grows 3 inches, which means that if he was 28 inches before, he's 28 plus 3 inches. So there's the idea of concatenation. So in other words, we can have a model for addition where if we want to add two fractions, we take the two fractional lengths and then simply concatenate them, and then we get the sum. Now, when we do this, when we build up this model for addition in terms of concatenation, we have the idea that, okay, if we add two positive fractions together, then the sum has to be bigger than the two fractions. Okay, so what we're doing is providing this kind of intuition. And when we come to multiplication, well, there are different models for multiplication. One is multiplication in the sense of a dilation of the line. Okay, so let me say basically what I mean by this. Suppose I want to discuss 2 times 3. Okay, so I start with my number line, and I'll just look at the positive half. Now, the idea is that if we multiply by 2, what does multiplying by 2 amount to? Well, 2 times 1 is equal to 2, so multiplying by 2 takes 1 to 2, it takes 2 to 4. It takes 3 to 6. So multiplication by a fixed multiplier is a kind of dilation of the line. We're making a scale change of the line. Okay? So 2 times 3 bears the same ratio to 3 as 2 bears to 1. Okay? So 2 times 3 bears the same ratio to 3 as 2 bears to 1. Now, how does that come into fractions? Well, if we want to multiply by 2/3, okay, suppose we multiply 2/3 times 6. Well, we look at the same way. We look and see what happens to 1. Well, 1 times anything is the anything. Okay, multiplying by 1 doesn't change the number. So 1 times 2/3, which is 2/3 times 1, should be that, 2/3. So if we have the intuition that multiplication represents a dilation of the line, then what we have is that multiplication is a scale transformation of the line, which brings things closer to the origin. So 2/3 times 6, well, if 6 is out here, then it should be a scale transformation of the line, so it should draw into something smaller. Okay. So if we sort of have this kind of model of what multiplication is, then the children begin to understand that multiplication by a fraction which is less than 1 should give us something smaller than the thing we're multiplying it by because of this kind of coherence of the dilation, you see. So what we're doing is that we're giving a kind of mental representation of multiplication that counters the natural idea that children might have from multiplication of numbers, that multiplication always makes something bigger. Okay? So here the teacher has to be sure to build the right foundation for the intuition that leads to a broader, more textured idea of multiplication. The other way of approaching multiplication is through multiplication by rectangle. I've discussed this in a little more detail in the notes, but the idea is that if I multiply 5 by 3, imagine that those are equal squares, 3 times 5, then I have 15 square units. Now if I want to multiply 2/3 by 4/7, so I take a square of side 1, I come up 2/3 along here, I come along 4/7 along here, and then I can argue that 2/3 times 4/7 should represent the area of this rectangle, and by counting little squares, I can argue that this is 8 squares out of 21 squares in the rectangle. So, now, there's a whole lot more that can be done to build this kind of representational space for fractions. But if we are willing to take the time, and as I've said before, we've got 6 years to do this in the elementary school, if we're willing to take the time to give the experiences and to direct the thoughts of the students into the right sort of models, then the properties of fractions, the ways of manipulating them, will then become natural, and then we're prepared to treat them in a more rigorous and more formal way later on, once we've laid the intellectual foundation for that. Well, I see that I've just about run through the time that I think I can respectively ask of you, so I think I'll stop at this, and I think maybe we've got 5 minutes to entertain a couple of questions or comments. And thank you very much for your attention. I see as formalism as being somehow a little bit more symbolic and abstract. I think the idea of formalism is that you become a little bit more abstract. You start playing with the objects solely on the basis of the properties that you've already postulated. Whereas I see rigor as having a little bit broader sense. Rigor is sort of precise reasoning, but can be done, I think, in an informal, formal way. I think the difference is a little bit in the eye of the beholder. But I think that one of the problems when we start talking about proof in the school curriculum is that some people's idea of proof is that it has to be something like the stuff that we used to get in Euclidean geometry. You know, we have a theorem and then you sort of line things up with reasoning. And I see it, I think, as a more gradual approach, where this is the kind of culmination. And I see it's something that's developed through encouraging the kids to make a more cogent analysis It can be just, to begin with, I think it can be a matter of sort of looking at possibilities in a systematic or orderly way. One question that I like to ask of kids is the following. Suppose I take any four points in the plane, okay? And I'm not going to suppose that they lie in a line, okay? Now, these four points involve six pairs of points, okay? And these six pairs have different distances apart. Okay, so generally, four points will determine six different distances between pairs of them. And then I ask the students, well, what I'd like you to do is to give me all possible configurations of four points where these six distances only represent two different numbers. Okay? Now, where I think the rigor comes into that is that, first of all, students are just sort of messing around and coming up with ideas. Almost everybody, if you try this on a group, almost everybody at some point will come up with a square because, okay, four of the pairs give you the sides of the squares, which is one length, and the other two pairs give you the diagonal. Okay. And then, as time goes on, they may come up with other possibilities. Almost never does every possibility come up. Okay. In fact, there's one that almost everybody misses. Okay. Now, what's interesting, of course, is the pictures that students have in their minds when they're coming up with this. But at some point, the issue arises, okay, suppose I've got a few of these things. How do I know whether I should keep on looking or not? Okay, so that's the question. And so now it then becomes a question of organizing your thoughts and then saying, okay, let's look at the sort of possible ways these distances come together. Okay, so you begin to reason. You say, okay, I've got six possible distances, and if there's only two numbers, then that means that some distance must be represented at least three times. Okay? So then you start thinking, okay, well, let's arrange the points so that three distances are the same. How many ways can I do that? And then how can I build from that? Okay. So you start getting into this analysis. Now, I would say that this is still can operate at a fairly informal argumentative level in a kind of tentative way. It's not formal in the sense that I'm sort of using fancy notation or anything like that. But it's sort of formal in the way that I'm trying to use the English language in a very precise way. There was a paper written many years ago by David Gale was one of the writers, and it was on the marriage problem. Okay? And the problem is the following. Suppose that I've got an equal number of young men and young ladies, and I'm the matchmaker, and I want to marry these people off. Okay. Now, I want the marriages that I assign to be stable in the following sense. That I don't want to marry any man to a woman who prefers some other man to the husband that she's assigned, and at the same time, that other husband would prefer her to the wife that she has. Okay? Because if that happens, then they'll go off together into the twilight and we'll have a... Okay. So, now, so what the marriage maker does is to ask each man to list in order of preference all the women that he might get married. The one he wants most of all first, the next one second, and so on. And then ask the women to do the same. Okay. So the theorem is that there's always a way of assigning the couples so that you don't have this mutual defection likely to occur. Okay? And so they go ahead and prove this. And at the end of the article, Gale says, you know, I've gone through this whole discussion. Every mathematician will recognize this as a rigorous argument. And yet, the whole argument is carried out in plain English. There's not a mathematical symbol anywhere in the argument. So, and I think that one of the messages that I would like to leave with you today is that rigorous mathematics is not necessarily symbolic mathematics. Rigorous mathematics can be pursued in clear, ordinary, garden variety English sentences, and in many cases ought to be, that sometimes the symbolism befuddles and throws an extra spanner in the works and confuses. And I think if you take that attitude, then I think you'll find that you can bring down the rigor to quite an early grade in the appropriate circumstances.
Yeah. Pardon me? What is the shape that almost nobody gets?
Oh, do you want me to tell you or should I tell you privately? Okay. Pardon? No? Okay. Why don't I leave it with you and at the end of the day... Pardon? I think there's six. Six, yes. No, there's six. And I think most of you will probably get four in quite short order, and possibly five. Okay. In fact, the other thing I want to say is that every time I've done this, I've sort of learned something. Because it's very interesting how people arrive at the answers. Okay. Yes?
When you were doing this this ladder problem,
yes,
you obviously prefer the ironing boards.
Yes.
And it's very beautiful because you have the falling ladder and the other one, the sliding ladder. But the thing that you rejected, with a median of a right angle triangle, if a student came along and said, well, this completes into a rectangle.
Oh, yes.
The same argument.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the same argument. In fact, if you look in the notes, that was my argument. I didn't think of the ironing board until after I made up those notes that are in your package. You see, what happens is...
The question is really, why did you prefer the... Why did you show us the ironing board rather than the other?
Oh. Because... Well, let me tell you how I thought of the ironing board. My wife and I like to watch the McNeil Air News Hour, some PBS. And she always brings in her irony to do this, you see. So she's ironing away while I'm sitting there loafing and watching this thing. And I sort of thought as she was sort of folding up the ironing board, this is the thing that I've just been talking about. But I'll tell you why. Well, the ironing board and the rectangle. The ironing board is just a dressing up of the rectangle argument. Okay. But I'll tell you why I prefer the rectangle idea is that it seemed to be more direct to imagine the right angle triangle being completed to a rectangle and then recognizing that the midpoint of the ladder is the intersection point of these diagonals. Then to sort of start, you see, if you try to prove it directly, you start with the midpoint of the ladder. And then somehow you've got to show that this length is the same as that. Or equivalently, that this angle is the same as that, and this angle is the same as that. And when I thought about it, it seemed to me that you sort of, in effect, had to do a kind of contradiction argument. Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. And that's what I would do with the kids. But I think my objection to this is if you start with the theorem that the midpoint of the hypotenuse of a right triangle is the center of the circumference, if you start with that theorem, then you've got a conceptually a fairly elaborate thing and something that's more advanced than, say, the elementary curriculum.
Generalizable with the ironing board, when you remove the restriction that it has to be the midpoint, you can take any point along the ladder, and then it becomes a different problem, and you don't have the theorem to work with in the first analysis.
Yeah, now what would happen if you take a point the third way up the ladder? Then I think you might... Okay, I haven't thought about that, so I'm not going to think about it now. But I will think about it.
I wanted to remind you that the matter